You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Exclusively on Paramount Plus. Get ready.
Vamanos!
To explore like never before.
Swiper knows. Swiping!
Oh, man!
Swing into action.
We need your help.
Woohoo!
Yay!
With a girl who put adventure on the map.
I don't think I can do it, Doral.
I'll protect you, Boots. Together, we got this.
Todos juntos!
Yay!
Dora, the brand new series. Stream with your family now, exclusively on Paramount Plus.
The analogy I always make when you're working on a new piece is that I'm just the midwife. Like, I'm the one that wants to make sure the baby comes out alive, 10 fingers, 10 toes, breathing, you know, and, like, full of potential, really.
This is East Side Story, and I'm your host, Chiang Ung. Each week, I sit down with an Asian or Asian American artist working in the New York theater scene, and I excavate their life story. How they grew up, how they got their start in theater, as well as projects they've worked on and upcoming work that we should anticipate. This week's guest is Desdemona Chang. She just received the 2019 Princess Grace Award for her work at the Fifth Avenue Theater. She is also the co-artistic director of Asiotrope in Seattle, and her directing credits include the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Seattle Rep, and Classic Stage Company in New York. I got the opportunity to work with Desdemona on my musical, Eastbound, at the Village Theater's Festival of New Musicals, and we snuck into a studio in Seattle just to record this episode. Enjoy!
And we're going to jump into...
Jump in.
Jump right in. Tell people who you are, what you do, and a little bit of, like, a little tidbit about yourself.
Good gosh. My name is Desdemona Chang. I am a theater director based in Seattle and Ashland, Oregon. And I work primarily in New York and Shakespeare, which I guess is kind of like everything, I guess. It's either classical work, it's either old stuff or new stuff. Yeah, I guess I kind of do.
Everything. Everything. And how long have you been directing?
Ooh, I mean, it depends on when you start calling yourself a professional, really. And I would comfortably say 15 years.
Wow.
Right. I got my first review in the paper about 15 years ago. And that was, like, of course, you know, 99-seat black box production. But that's out of college, kind of, you know, that's pretty much when I started.
This is the teaser. We're going to, before we delve onto all of that, we're going to, like, backtrack.
Yes.
To, like... Tell me how you grew up. Where did you grow up? And what is, like, that background? Do you have siblings? How is your family like?
Yeah, okay.
What was that like?
Ooh, okay. I'm an only child, which means I'm very generous and very selfish at the same time. It means you can have anything of mine that you want to use, but just know that it's mine. I was born in Taiwan and came to the U.S. when I was 3 and a half. My parents came on a student visa, and I was raised by my grandmother in Taipei. And I have very, very faint memories. Like, my first memories of being alive are of Taiwan.
Wow.
Right? So it's like taxi cabs and, you know, streets. And of course, you know, when I was younger, we'd go back and forth during the holidays because at the time, my great-grandmother was still alive.
Mm.
And so once she passed away, I was 9 years old. And like, that's when my grandmother moved to America. And so my whole family is now living in America, in L.A. I'm pretty much an ABC, even though I'm not technically born in America.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've been raised as with American social values.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese home values, but American public values. You know what I mean?
Oh my God. That, like, juxtaposition is, like, so real.
Yeah.
So real.
Yeah. So, so we would, you know, over the holidays, whenever I'd be on winter break from elementary school, my parents and I would go back to Taiwan and, you know, and always was able to overlap somewhat with Chinese New Year, which is great because then you got a little bit of it depends on what the year was.
Right,
sometimes
right.
It'd be like, great, winter break is right up against January, right near Chinese New Year. You get all the hongbao and everything. It's great. My upbringing was largely in Southern California, east of downtown LA, mm-hmm. In a very immigrant-heavy, a lot of Asian folks, a lot of Latinx folks, a lot of Black folks. And so I've always grown up in a very multicultural environment. Mm-hmm. And then kind of didn't do, I mean, as far as like getting into the world of theater, didn't really do a lot of theater growing up. Mm-hmm. Like any good Chinese kid, I was going to be a doctor because I had this moment when I was, I must have been five or something, mm-hmm. and my parents were in a car and my parents were arguing about something. And apparently they were arguing about my college tuition.
Wow, when you were five.
5 years old, sitting in the back seat. And remember, and my parents had gone to Cal State Fullerton, mm-hmm. which was like, you know, a lovely state school in Southern California. And my dad was like, well, she can go to Cal State Fullerton. My mom was like, no, she's not. She's going to Harvard. And she turns around and she looks at me and she says, you're going to go to Harvard, right? And I was like, I don't know, what's Harvard? She's like, yes, you're going to go to Harvard.
I can't believe you can remember this when you were five.
Yeah, well, it's because it was such a pointed moment of my mom looking me dead in the eye and like, do not fail me. You're going to go Ivy League. Don't fuck this up. You're 5 years old. Don't fuck it up. And I was like, okay, I don't know what that was. My dad was like, why are you pressuring her to go to Harvard? She's five.
But, oh my God.
But from then, I've always had this feeling of like needing to achieve, right? And of course, I'm also the oldest of all the grandchildren in the family. Mm. And even though like my next cousin, the cousin who's younger than me is only younger by 3 months, mm. right? But there was still like, you're the oldest. You have to set an example. Whenever we have like family things, like you're in charge, right? So I felt like, and maybe, you know, on top of being an only child gave me a kind of tendency towards leadership, mm. you know? And
it reflects in your work.
Thank you.
Yeah, it really does. It does. It really does.
And for whatever reason, that also maybe is kind of adjacent to a desire to overachieve, you know?
Yep. I'm like,
I didn't even know what that was about other than I knew that I'm also like incredibly competitive, you know, and that helps. Mm-hmm. And I'm an only child. And so all the resources went to me. I never had to share. I'm very like narcissistic. My boyfriend would tell you that I'm very self, I guess he wouldn't say self-centered, very like self-actualized is what he would say. Mm. That there's very much like a me, the way I see the world. I'm very compassionate, but I'm also very narcissistic. Mm. But so growing up that way, I knew that success meant medical school. I knew that success meant, you know, like for some reason, like doctor happened to be the thing that was generically imprinted on me that I never really questioned. And it just so happened that I was very good at science, right? I went to school, public school in LA, and like when it came to like things like biology and calculus, I was like, boom, 4.0, like top 10, everything. And I did all the academic stuff, like mock trial, decathlon.
I don't know what all those things are.
Oh,
but
these are all like, yeah, these are all like extracurricular, smarty pants, nerdy programs.
Amazing.
That kids in public school do in America. And then so I did really, really well. I did not get into Harvard. My Aww. Mother was very sad when that happened. But the good news is that I went to UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And luckily, in some ways, I was very lucky to not get into Harvard because I think I would have maybe not liked it. I don't know, actually. Mm-hmm. I knew that when I was doing the tour of the various campuses I wanted to go to, my parents and I visited Berkeley. And within like 30 seconds of being in that area, I just, you know what? I'm coming here.
Wow.
But anyway, I guess, yeah. So I went to UC Berkeley and I was going to get a degree in biology.
Oh.
So they can go apply to medical school.
Yes.
And then the first semester of my freshman year, my undergraduate advisor said, Desdemona, you can't be taking all of these science classes. You're taking like physics, chemistry, calculus. You have to take an arts elective.
Aww.
And I was like, okay, fine. I have to take an arts class. And my friends in biology said, yo, you know, there's this class in the theater department. It's called Intro to Acting. It's a fucking joke. Okay? It's like you stand in a circle and you play this game called Zip Zap Zop all day and you play charades. No papers, no lectures, right? No tests. You just show up and you get an A for showing up. Dude, best class ever. And I was like, sweet, easy A. I'm going to med school. So I took this class called Intro to Acting in the theater department. And it was a class full of other engineers and bio people, like business school people, like a lot of like non-majors were in that class. And we did. We played Zip Zap Zop. And we totally played charades. And there were no papers, no lectures, and no tests. And I totally got an A. But that class was also when you start doing things like make intense eye contact with people. And you're doing the mirror exercise. And suddenly you're being vulnerable. And I was playing in a way that I was not playing when I was in high school or younger. Right? Came from a very serious environment, very studious, very austere. And so this idea of like finding a kind of release or creativity was new and scary and kind of exciting. And so after that, I thought, well, that was fun. I guess I'll take another acting class. And I would, so that began my like relationship with the theater department, where I would essentially spend my days in the lab in the bio department and then run across campus at 5 p.m. to like do tech or something for a show. And I was living two lives. I was living like bio by day, drama by night.
Wow.
And all of my friends, I mean, the friends in theater were just cooler. You know, the
parties. You heard it here first.
The theater kids were cooler. I think, you know, they were smoking cigarettes and like whatever. We had more but better booze, like the crazier parties. Like my friends and I were not having these ragers the way the theater kids were. And so at the time, I didn't know what, you know, the social value of theater, like the life-changing, transformative, all that stuff, right? I was just thinking, oh, this is fun. I love doing it. It makes me happy. It's a release. I don't have to worry about, like, derivatives and integrals and calculus and God knows what else, and right? So I was doing a lot of that. It was the thing I wanted to, the thing I had to do during the day and the thing I wanted to do at night.
Wow. You live such dual lives.
Yes.
You like, there's so much duality in terms of like you being an only child and you being compassionate, but also like narcissistic and then like loving theater, but also like a science person. Like,
yeah,
it's beautiful.
I'm a very polarized psychology.
I love it. It's like, oh my God.
And this is why, like when I read Eastbound, I was like, oh, holy moly. I totally understand like the way the play is cut in half. And I, in some ways, I also do think, for me, like philosophically, the world works when there's contrast.
Yes.
Right. And yes. And this is also the nut of like when you see good work, there's variety in good work. Like there is no sweet without the bitter. Mm-hmm. Right. There is no good without the evil. All of those things. Like it can't just be a one-sided story you're telling.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, contradiction and contrast, I tend to gravitate toward that. Mm-hmm. And because I feel like then you see the potential for what range feels like, what a spectrum can be. Yeah, I don't know. So that's...
And that was your first foray into theater. So college was your first foray into theater.
Like officially, yes. I mean, I did like one school play when I was in high school because I thought it would be good on my resume.
Because I was like, I love that it's like because it will look good on my resume so that I can go get into Harvard.
Yeah, pretty that much. Kind of like... I was like, what else have I not done? I should do a theater thing. Yeah, I'll do that.
And
I
diversifying your resume. That's great.
Yeah, we did a production of Midsummer Night's Dream, and I played. I don't know. I played the role of like Hermia's father, but really her mother, Aegea. She has like two lines on top of the play and then like disappears at the end. So it was like, great, boom, tick that off. On my resume, drama. it was a great resume pattern. And I really didn't take seriously all the things that were involved and certainly was not invested emotionally in the role.
And what do you think changed? I mean, you just said that when you were in college, you started doing theater, right? And even though that play didn't like change you or transform you, like, was there a pivotal moment where it was like, oh, this is what I need to be doing? I mean, because it's a huge leap.
It's a huge leap.
Yeah.
That didn't happen for me until after I graduated.
Oh.
Because for a long time, you kind of go, great, great, great. I finished school. I had 4 years of fun with my theater mistress. Now it's time to hunker down and actually like get a job and like be real, right? Like grow the fuck up and get a real job.
Right.
So I graduated with a double major.
I can't. I love that you're so overachieving and then you're like, Yes, yes. I am doing all these things, but also I'm also killing it in my academic department.
At a certain point, clearly, if you were to look at my transcript from undergrad, uh-huh. the number of drama classes that started to creep in, by the end, I was taking the bare minimum to finish my biology major, and I was taking, like, 20th century feminist drama, and I was taking, like, all of these extracurricular theater classes.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
it was pretty apparent that, like, I did achieve both things, but I wasn't, like, loving all the work and bio,
right,
you know?
Right.
I finished it because I knew that it was a thing I had to do and a thing I actually intended to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I did call my mom, and I was like, Mom, so I'm thinking about doing theater. And there's a silence on the other end of the phone.
Like, you came out.
I came out as a theater artist. She was like, okay, I want to support your choices. I want to, see, I'm going to be a cool mom. I'm going to be an American mom. I'm going to try to, like, support my daughter's radical decision to do more theater. And I think for a long time, she was hoping that I would just kind of get over it.
Oh my God, this is such an Asian parent thing.
You know, like, it's a phase. Yeah. Once she realizes that she'll go broke doing this, she'll give up and she'll go to law school. Because there was a moment where I decided that I wasn't going to go to med school.
Wow.
And that was, that came actually while I was at Berkeley. I had a moment where it became clear that medicine wasn't going to work for me. And it was a very potent moment when, in my junior year, I was taking a class called Human Anatomy. And anatomy was when you had to dissect cadavers.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, a dead body. You had human bodies. So you had human bodies and body bags. And, you know, it was a big group class. And you had to unzip a body bag. And there was a male and a female cadaver. One was face up, one was face down. And you would essentially go through and look at all the organs, all the tissues. You have to because, duh, you're taking a biology class,
but I'm, like,
right?
So in shock now.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah. But you have to do that. And I remember walking in class that first day and seeing two body bags in the classroom. And I just kind of went, oh, that's two people.
Yeah.
Two people. And the way that I found to do the work well, you can't get touchy-feely about it, right?
Yeah.
It's tissues and cells and specimens and organs. And it's a very clinical approach at looking at disease.
Wow.
And a very clinical way of looking at pathology. And for me, that was what biology was about.
Mm.
And meanwhile, I'm going to do theater. And
where
we're
you
talking,
need to be all vulnerable and just, shit.
Yep.
And, like, open yourself up and,
yeah.
like, oh,
right.
my God. I'm, like, getting, like, oh,
the
chills. I'm, like... No.
All the feelings. So I was like trying. So whatever biology was undoing the work theater was doing, and theater was undoing the work that biology was doing.
Wow.
And it was hard for me to study things like human suffering without asking myself, why is there suffering in the world? Why is the yeah. world bad? Why is there cancer? Why do people get cancer? Right?
Did you find an answer?
No. I don't. I mean, that's why we do art, because we keep looking for that answer,
yeah.
right? We don't know what happens after we die. We don't know when the beginning of time was. We don't know all the big questions.
Yeah.
But it was hard to focus on the details of the science when I was constantly being prodded by big questions in the arts.
Right.
So that class, it taught me a lot about anatomy, of course, but it also taught me a lot about my capacity to hold my emotional vessel got so big because of theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I would find myself in, like, anatomy class, like, you know, looking at organs and, like, weeping. It was in some ways a little embarrassing.
No, but, it's human.
Yeah. And I would look at, because also we had above these body bags were, like, the death certificates of the people. They would black out the names. So we didn't know the names of the individuals, but you saw, like, you know, male, African-American, 67, died of kidney failure. And so I would just, like, look at this information and in my mind start constructing a narrative about who this person was, how did they die, how did they get kidney failure, did they have any loved ones, like, where do they live? And I was like, this is not helping me with my studies.
Yeah.
This is not a great way to be doing a science thing, right?
Yeah.
So that I think, was what just happened to click for me at the time.
And then praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary, and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And you didn't think that that was the turning point. You thought that you personally think that your turning point was after college.
Yeah. So I graduated undergrad, and then I didn't know what to do with myself. Mm. You know, I didn't want to take the GRE and go to grad school for something I didn't really care about.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell into this like deep depression, which I think a lot of when I think about the number of folks I've talked to who like. In their mid-20s, go through some kind of, like, life crisis. It's not uncommon,
me.
Right? Yeah.
Literally me.
Yeah. Between the ages of 20 to 25, mm-hmm. there's that moment of, oh, I've been institutionalized my entire life from grade school, middle school, high school, university. I've been given a template for how to live for
my
so
life.
Long. And
yeah,
everything
yeah.
was always, I always knew what the next goalpost was.
Yeah.
And then once I graduated college, it just became... like this open field of possibility that was like very terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I was financially, like I did not have any sense of financial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, just being thrust into like adulting was
yeah.
a little tough. And then not knowing. And then for some reason, being preoccupied with the idea that I had to be happy in what I did.
I mean, like it feels like that's what everybody's striving for, no?
I mean, yes. But I think there's so many people out there for whom work is work, and to feel like happiness
is tied to your job satisfaction.
Yeah, it also feels like a very like first world problem kind of
oh,
thing.
Oh, absolutely. It's such a privilege.
Like, oh, poor baby, you don't love your job. Like, get the fuck over yourself. Yeah. I don't know. I just didn't know what I wanted to do with my career, like with my life, right? Mm. Like what is like the long game at this point? Once I cut the biology cord, it was like my entire concept of who I wanted to be was like gone. And I was like blank slate, and I was really scared. And I thought, I was like, well, when was I actually really happy?
Mm.
I was really happy when I was doing theater. Okay, so it's not going to pay any bills, but let me at least do some small shows during the day. I mean, or during the evening, I'll do a day job. And so I was like temping and then doing like small black box shows at night.
Right. As a director, you know? Or as an actor?
I first got involved with a small theater company in Berkeley called Impact Theater as an actor. Mm. I went to like a general audition and I got cast as Lady Macduff in a production of Macbeth. I had one kick-ass fight scene and like four lines. It was fantastic. And there's a lot of strawberry jam as blood involved. It was a very campy machine gun,
great
basement theater, Shakespeare. It was so much fun though, right? Like it was definitely not high art, but it was very fun. And I felt, and that was when I felt like engaged and connected again with people. And so I thought, great, I'll just keep doing that. And so then that led to like assisting on a show and then eventually directing for them. And then meanwhile, I had gotten a job working in new media, just doing like marketing stuff, a very corporate-y kind of mm-hmm. position. I did that for a couple of years and then decided, you know, I think I actually want to do the theater thing for real. And people ask, like, my family, like, are you going to make money? How are you going to eat? How are you going to pay your rent?
Uh-huh.
You know? And my mom is like, oh, my God, she's going to be a cabaret singer somewhere. She's going to be, like, you know, busking on the street. I can't sing, first of all. But the equivalent of, you know, in some dingy jazz club or something. She was just so nervous about, like, my integrity.
Yeah. I mean, my mom recently came for my thesis project, and she said, it's not too late if you don't want to do this anymore.
At your thesis project? Goodness,
yeah.
You're getting a master's degree.
I know.
Come
and then
on.
She said, on the steps of Grand Central, she said, if you decide that you don't want to do this anymore, we can always start somewhere new. Like, just start afresh.
Oh,
and I was
God.
Like, was my thesis project that bad?
But But yeah, but my mom was definitely a little like, okay, so, you know, she's going to do theater for the rest of her life. I'm a little nervous. She's like, how are you going to make it work? And then I decided, do I want to go to grad school? Mm-hmm. You know, I've been out of school for 5 years. It wouldn't hurt to get reinstitutionalized again into a program. It would give me some structure.
Yes, yes.
So I applied and then, you know, got an interview with the University of Washington in Seattle. Mm. And then came here for an interview. And within 30 seconds of landing in Seattle, I was like, I want to come here.
Wow.
I walked down University Avenue. And it was really funny. I walked down University Avenue right by UW. And all it was, I just saw a bento restaurant. And I was like, there's a bento restaurant here. I'm coming here.
I mean, you said that you wanted to go to Berkeley. This, like, also 30 seconds. Yeah. In 30 seconds.
It was very much. And I didn't, wow. I mean, and I didn't know if I would get in because, you know, I don't know if you know, but directing programs for grad school are pretty competitive. Mm-hmm. It takes, at UW, they take 2 every other year.
Wow.
So I was like, all right, fingers crossed. And I went in. It was a 4-hour long interview slash, you know, directing demonstration you do where they make you direct the first act of the Cherry Orchard or something crazy. Uh-huh. But, you know, they flew me in. I did the interview. I went back home to San Francisco. And then, you know, the following Tuesday, I got a phone call that was like, we wanted to accept you in the program. And I was
wow.
like,
yeah. I mean, I totally feel you there in terms of like being out of school, having no structure, going into the world blind, and then like craving structure and like mm-hmm. craving. That's also why I went back to grad school, like craving some kind of like institutional, being like, you have to go to this, you have to come to school this time and like attend this amount of classes.
Yeah, do not get drunk, do not cut class. Like, it's funny because at the time, like when you're an undergrad, when I was an undergrad, I was not like, when I try to impart onto young people the value of education and academia, it's like, you don't get it. You don't get it.
You really
lose it.
Don't get it. Like, I mean, I'm the same way when, and it's cyclical. It just happens to everybody. Because when you're in it, you just don't know.
You're like, ugh, I just want out. This is awful. Yeah. And once you're out, you're like, please put me in that sweet, sweet womb of academia. I just want to be cradled by the womb of academia again. Please.
Safety.
Yeah.
And doesn't have to, like, if you fail, that's fine. Like, it's just like,
yeah.
Do whatever the fuck you want.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And, so I missed that. So I went into grad school in Seattle very, very cognizant of the inevitable graduation date. And so from day one, I was like, okay, I got 3 years. I will not graduate and fall into a second depression where I don't have structure. And so really from my first day of grad school, I was planning like, okay, internships, fellowships, jobs, gigs.
We are so Asian. I feel like only the Asians will do that. I'm seriously, I went into grad school. I said, this is masterclass time. I'm going to take every single minute, every single second as like a time to learn and then like figure out what I want to do with the rest of my life and like plant the seeds so that I can, you know, take step at a step at a step at a step at a time so that I can, well, I'm not succeeding in terms of like what I envision it to be, but I think I'm on the way, you know, like planting those seeds from day one of grad school.
Yeah, that's how I felt. I just knew that I was not going to let myself graduate and then be in this, oh no, what now place? Because I remember feeling so helpless when that happened to me and feeling like I had no agency, which was complete bullshit because I had complete agency. And I just, either I didn't know it or didn't realize it or couldn't tap into it for whatever reason.
Right.
I just was determined to not feel like, I didn't want to wake up the day after graduation and go, okay, now what? Mm. Right. I want to be able to go, day after graduation, great, I'm going to my next project. Or I'm going to go into rehearsal in like a week or a month, whatever it was. I just wanted to know that there was a next step in front of me after I graduated.
But that 100% is Asian, though. Like, it really is. I'm generalizing, and that is not a good thing to do, but it's true. That's my experience, in my experience.
Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, this is quite a life story. Yeah. And there's still more to go.
Oh my gosh.
But do you think being Chinese has shaped that progression in any way?
I mean, I guess it has to, because I don't know what it's like to not be Chinese.
Yeah.
You know, all I have is my point of view with, I was just quoting the lyrics from the song, I just realized. I mean, really, the lens on how I see the world is inevitably Chinese. People ask, like, do you have any regrets, right? The only regrets I didn't start sooner. Right. And also it's tricky too, because then you get into this question of like, okay, am I entering a field that doesn't have me in its legacy too, right? You're talking about, you know, I'm studying like Shakespeare and Chekhov and Ibsen and the entire time. And it never occurred to me that the training that I was getting was a very Eurocentric, because you don't question the things that you're taught when you're learning them. And so you make these like subconscious agreements around, you know, what value is, what constitutes good art, what constitutes legitimate art. And so, I mean, we hope I, you know, right turn into a different conversation around identity and things like that. But there's a little anxiety too around like once I, if I were to, like the thing I love so much doing theater, like is there room for me in that world? Will they take me? Because I don't look like the history of what that institution is, you know?
And how did you grapple with that?
It's actually one of the reasons why I started directing is because I auditioned for things all the time and never got cast. And just was like, I must really suck as an actor. And I think on some of I probably am not a very good actor. But the fact that, like, why am I not being cast in Streetcar? Why am I not being cast in Noises Off? This is, I must really suck. You know what? If I, and I so wanted to hang out with the same people. Like, I wanted to be around those people. So I said, you know, if you're not going to cast me, I will find a way to be the one doing the casting.
That is also so Asian.
And it's hard because, you know, like, how do you become a director? How do you get into that? Well, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, the right person has to entrust you with a project, or you have the money, you save enough pennies, and you make it your damn self, right? At the end of the day, like, how do you end up becoming the person in charge?
Having been in the room with you for how many days now? Four days. But also, like, more than that, because we've been having conversations for a while. Like, the way you work is so sensitive to every single human being in the room. And I think that's, I mean, I think a lot of good directors are like that. Right. But to be able to balance all the energies that are flying around the room at any given time, not be flustered, be able to take in everything and process that, I feel like that is a gift in itself. And you said that grad school gave you the tools to, like, do that. Do you want to share a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of what you're talking about, the people management part of the, I think that has a lot to do with who I am as a human. You know, I'm not emotional, but I'm not prone to like extreme emotional reactions. So I tend to temper feelings really well. I tend to work well under stress. I don't flip out. I don't panic. And so I think because of that, I'm able to handle high octane material.
That's you.
That's me. That's me as a human.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like we had a moment today in rehearsal where I was talking about like when people, you know, like we were talking about the character of Ching and whether or not she, when she gets angry, does she hit or does she cry?
Right.
Like I don't have a really bad temper, so when I get really upset, if I get truly, truly upset, I'll start crying.
Wow.
I don't externalize my, I don't, like, lash out, you know?
What do you think are good qualities that a director should have, other than what I was discussing?
I think, I mean, honestly, the thing the director absolutely needs to have is the ability to make choices. Like, the ability to make decisions. A director is a person who makes choices, right? And to make them and be accountable for them, right? For me, there's a responsibility that comes with the job. And so the director's job is to take a piece of work, reduce and clarify it and, through a series of choices and be able to defend those choices. Everything else is personality. Everything else is like, sure. And through that can involve nurturing. That can involve things like collaboration. But at the end of the day, if you tell me X or Y, and I'm staging something, I should be able to tell you X or Y. And then X or Y, and then say Y. Or, I mean, not Y, the letter Y, W-H-Y-Y. That was a horrible example, I but mean, you got it, right?
A or B, and then Y.
and then be able to, right? Because I think the irresponsible director is the person who doesn't make a choice, and then by default, a choice gets made because that person didn't intend to make a choice, right? There has to be intentionality and then accountability with the work. If I make this choice, I'm going to make this choice, and I have to stand behind it. And then if I fail, I have to, like, be accountable for that failure.
But also, like, going through, like, the duality of your life, I feel like being a director, it's also, you have to be a really good collaborator. And you're saying, like, you have to make all these decisions. Yes, these decisions have to be made. But there's also, like, so many other people that are involved that you have to work with. And, like, you have to, like, take into account all their suggestions and their thoughts and their feelings and basically everything. And their expertise, too, right? Because everyone has their strengths.
Yeah.
And then making a clear decision on that.
Yeah, it only benefits me to get all the feedback I can get, because at the end of the day, I get to pick. You know what I mean? Like, but I don't understand directors who don't listen to other people, because like, what's the threat? I'm the one, I mean, I'm the powerful person in the room. Like, I don't know what the fuss is about. Like, why directors can't listen to other people. Like, the worst thing that happens is I hear you and go, okay, cool, that was wrong, I don't want to do that. Moving on.
It's very similar to writing when you get so many opinions, so, like, inundated with, like, so many opinions. At the end of the day, you're making the decision. You're the ones putting the words on the page, right? So, listen to yourself, but take into account all these other factors that, I mean, all have valid reasons for existing.
Yeah. And the only reason why a director, I mean, the only reason why I would not listen to somebody is because there's not enough time.
Mm.
Time would be the only obstacle to me being able to take into account all the feedback in the room.
I feel like time is always like the least, like, you have to dig for it. You have to, like, really fight for it. You have to find it. And because if we have, like, a 2-month rehearsal process, so much can be done.
Right. The only two limiting factors are time and money to get in the way of doing the thing you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I either can't afford it or I don't have time to do it.
And that also applies to life.
Right.
Just thinking about that.
Time and money. Time and money. Right. Either I can spend an hour cleaning my house or I can pay someone to clean my house.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Such first world problems.
I know, because we have running water and antibiotics.
Like today we were in rehearsal and Daniel was kind of like on his phone. Shout out to Daniel and being on his phone. But he said this line and it made me think a lot. The world is falling the fuck apart. People are dying. Yes. Shit is going down. Yes. And we're here in a fucking rehearsal room doing theater.
Yeah, lucky us, right?
And it like makes you feel like helpless and little in a way, but then you know, like what I said earlier, like, you know, when a work works, there's like an infinite way and path to healing.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you justify doing theater? Like, you know what I'm saying, right? Like,
this is what I plague myself with so often, right? Because we go, I mean, the more you become aware about the many other ways. If I wanted to save lives, I would have been a doctor.
Exactly. Which I, so full circle, I love it. Like, yes, exactly that.
Yeah.
Right?
If I wanted to save lives, if I wanted to cure cancer, if I really wanted to do these things. I mean, at the end of the day, if I were to be really honest, it's because I'm selfish.
Mm.
Right? And I hate admitting, I mean, in a weird way, like, why does anyone do art? Art is an expression. And what makes my expression more valid than anyone else's expression?
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, people have decided that they want to see the things that I express. Like, I make people, for some reason, think that I'm the person they want to hire to tell the story.
Mm.
I think storytelling is super valuable. It's not the same thing as, you know, it's not as immediate and tangible as, like, medicine or surgery or, you know, funding someone to, you know, build a house. I don't know, right? There's so many ways you can actually do practical service or good.
But storytelling has been around since the beginning of time, right? For mankind, at least. Mm-hmm. I don't know about animals, but for mankind.
I bet dolphins tell stories.
Oh, my God.
That would be great. Sentient
Those are my favorite animals, honestly. Oh, I can't go into that. But storytelling has been around forever and it's still persisted. And then you question, like, why?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Is it because we need to tell stories in order to escape from the disasters of the world and the truths of the world?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we do it because we're telling the truths of the world in a way that maybe is a little bit more accessible to people?
I think it's because by nature, we're wired to be social creatures.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and if there's, I mean, what is news but storytelling, right? The daily news is telling, oh my God, this happened to me today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because our brains are wired to be social creatures. And it's the reason why solitary confinement is prison. It's punishment.
Right.
Time out for kids is punishment. You don't get to play at recess. You don't get to be with other people.
Right.
I think, and that's why we talk about people who are sociopaths, who can't empathize, who can't connect. This idea that punishment is about divorcing an individual from his community, from his society. Mm-hmm. And so I think storytelling, it's not necessarily fiction, but just storytelling is the act of communicating, is the act of exchanging thoughts and opinions and feelings between two individuals. And that can be something as great as, oh my God, the world is fucked, we have to fix it. That can be Shakespeare. And that can also be, oh my God, I saw this great thing at the store today. Or like, I saw this cat. Here's this cat meme, right? That's storytelling. Like Instagramming is storytelling. So I think for me, it's that simple. It's the exchange of ideas. Mm-hmm. Ideas, opinions, feelings.
Because we're social creatures.
Because we're naturally social creatures. I think that's kind of where I am with it. And theater is, you know, the most archaic version of that, that just somehow hasn't been contaminated. I mean, it's clearly been contaminated by technology, but it's still, it's our version of gathering at the fire and sharing an experience. It just so happens, and now it's taken the form of sit in a theater, be quiet, watch these lights, and people get to, you know, reenact stuff, right? That's just a particular form of storytelling. Right. But theater is the art of communication. We just communicate.
What does Colgate mean by live life to the brightest? Could it be a rich glass of red sipped inside a Parisian cafe on a snowy night when my gaze is met by a tall, mysterious... I mean, brushing is directed with Colgate Optic White Pro Series Toothpaste gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 3 days, so you can live life to the brightest and finish that glass without worrying about teeth stains. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
And you've worked around the country, all over the country regionally, directing project after project after project.
Yes.
And talk about what that experience is like going around the country and like sharing your vision on work that has been existing for a long time, like Shakespeare, or like new work like Lauren Yee's plays and new musicals. Like, what is the difference between all these processes? What is the similarity? And what's like the best thing that you love about your job doing this?
The best thing, okay, so I'll start with what I love about my job. I get to travel, which is great. And that varies from like big cities to small towns. I also, there's, this is probably not the most noble thing to say, but when you're a guest artist, no one ever gets sick of you. You're always, they're always excited to see you. They're always sad when you go.
You're always
so deeply valued. And this constant feeling of gratitude and appreciation is like, I can't get enough of that. People always love me when I show up, and they're always so sad when I go. And
But you need to know, like, that's because you're doing good work, right? Can you imagine if you're not? Like,
well,
why would
I wouldn't get hired. I wouldn't be, I'd be at home and depressed and not working. Directing in particular, and I'm sure acting too, it's a very promiscuous craft. We have to practice promiscuity, and we have to practice this idea of intense vulnerability and intense engagement. I have to go out, I have to meet these strangers, you know, mostly strangers, some friends, right? First day of rehearsal, you go into a process, you throw stuff into it, you love really hard, 4.5 weeks later, and I leave.
That is actually something.
And it's like, it's like constantly like meeting and loving and breaking up, meeting and loving and breaking up.
Does that wear on you a little bit? Because I know that that process always drove me a little crazy.
Like the saying goodbye part?
Like coming together and being like, yes, I love you. And then it's also the very American I love you. It's not like, you know how like Chinese people don't like immediately go like, yes, you know, and like
totally.
And then it's like, okay, wait, but do you actually love me, or like is it just like you're just doing
the
thing?
Are you just practicing the motions of I love you?
Exactly.
Really.
And then you always will have like one or two that you really, really people that you connect with, right, on your contract. And it's like
when your friends after the show's over, right?
Yeah,
and then there's the showmances, and then there's the ones that like last beyond the showmance.
Yeah, and those that actually last will be forever.
Yeah, they're your friends.
Really.
Yeah.
But then it's like, that is a process that's like, I haven't gotten used to it.
Yeah. It's something I've learned to, I mean, it's probably why I don't get super reactionary in rehearsals. I learned to traffic in feelings. I learned to traffic in that world of intense vulnerability, intense availability, and then be able to set like reasonable boundaries around
it. Right. So for yourself.
Yeah, for myself. And, you know, I in my process, once we hit tech, I slowly start backing out of the room. You know? And I mean, not literally, but I mean, oh my God, actors, don't listen to this, right? But it's useful because it's part of the detaching process is so that when the show opens, the actors are like, get out of here, director. This is our show now. We're going to take it. We're going to run with it. We're going to like do the thing. Great. What they don't want, again, it's that it's a version of I'm going to grad school. There's going to be an end. Get ready for the end. Mm. Right. You have to prepare for that moment when you leave. It's bittersweet, but they're ready to go. And by God, hopefully they don't need you there anymore. What I'm trying to practice now in my life is a greater embracing of impermanence, you know, because this is something about me that I don't really, I mean, I can talk about it. I'm like deeply afraid of dying, like mortality. I have like, I mean, it partially has to do with like my biology thing and the whole like cadavers in a bag. Yeah. But I remember, you know, attending when I was 8 years old, my great grandmother passed away in Taiwan and we went back to Taiwan to her funeral. And I'd never been to a funeral before.
So that was your first one?
My first one. And it was a fucking, like, the Buddhist funeral.
Yeah.
Cremation.
Yeah.
Chanting. Woodblocks. I mean, the ash in the air. It was traumatizing for me.
Wow.
To be
Wait,
like...
she was cremated in front of you?
Like, I did not go.
I was like, whoa.
But apparently, I mean, I didn't go. Like, my grandmother and I stayed behind. But they went up to, like, at the crematorium and...
Well, yeah. We go to crematoriums, too. But we don't see it burn. Like, we don't, like, have the ash, like, flying on your face. Is that a thing?
I don't know. I mean, it was definitely there, and I didn't go. My mom was like, you and grandma sit here. We're going to go. And I don't know what happened. All I knew is that I was exempt for those 2 hours.
Wow.
And we carried her clothes, and we were, like, throwing her clothes into, like, fires, throwing, like, her things. And it was it's part of the culture, and that's what they do. But for me, it was so harrowing and such a, like, this idea of... The things, this woman that I loved, and us burning her things, and she's dead, and I remember my parents took me to like view the body beforehand, and it was like in Taiwan, and there were other bodies around, like covered in mosquito netting. It was just not a very, like, it was not a funeral of like polite tears, right? Like, I think in America, funerals are very austere and polite, and they're like tears, and it's a coffin, and there's a lot of like white flowers. It was this loud, clangy, wailing Buddhist funeral.
Wow.
Right? And so after experiencing that, I've been very terrified of death, of mortality, and you know, all the things that are, I think, humans are naturally afraid of anyway, but for me, that fear was super amplified after that. And so I've been, and part of the reason why I love theaters is just because it's perpetual creation. But
birth.
Yeah. Mm. And then finding ways to like dealing with ending, right? Mm. If I can constantly expose myself to ending and termination, I start to embrace the idea that the world is impermanent and that I can't, nothing is forever. I'm trying to like flex that muscle more. I want to flex that muscle. Like nothing's precious. It can't be precious. You know, you will die someday. The world will go. The sun will burn out someday. Like, find peace with that soon, because the more you latch onto it, the more it's going to suck when it has to happen.
I love that. I love that. Like, theater is giving you the process, and it's a process for you, right? Like, it's like for you to discover that idea of impermanence. I mean, I say it now, but I've never really been afraid of death.
Oh, and lucky.
and it's. I think it's weird. I think it's not that I'm not afraid of it. I think it's like I don't think about it constantly. Yeah. And I kind of like live my life where I'm like, if I die tomorrow, will I be okay? Like, will I be okay with where I am today?
Right. Yes. Ideally, that's what we want
to
do.
And I answer that every day with like, yes. Like, I am where I need to be today.
Yeah.
I'm doing everything that I want to
be
doing. Yeah. And just like seizing every moment and just going forward with it. And the idea of impermanence, I am such a small, tiny speck of dust in the whole concept of the universe. Mm-hmm. I mean, every time you go to a fucking museum, they show you like the timeline history of the world. And then you're like,
we're like
humans,
the last speckle.
Yeah, I was like, excuse me. Yeah, like, hello, we've not even existed from any time. I mean, there's huge existential crisis questions that I like live with daily, where I'm like, why are we here? Mm-hmm. Why are we doing the things that we do? But if you live your day to day, like being hard, like so weighed down by all of that,
yeah.
How are you gonna find joy?
How are you available to those things?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's, yeah. So
but I love that theater is helping just like unlock that for you and exploring that.
Yeah. I think a lot of what I'm trying to do ultimately is like, how do I escape the suffering of life?
Yeah. What's the dream?
Yeah.
Like, what's the...
God, I don't
What's
know.
The dream? Like the dream job, the dream project, the dream, like the goal. Like, I mean, this is a question I do ask all my guests, right? And it's not what's the dream, but how would you define success? But I'm also like on the parallel, like what is the dream? How do you define success? I think those two things are very much tied together a little bit. So what do you think?
I feel like I'm on the verge of some kind of change. I don't know what that is, probably because I'm approaching my midlife crisis, whatever that means. But I feel like I've been doing theater for like 15 years and I'm very happy regionally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, New York, for a long time I thought I wanted to do like New York and be on Broadway. And I think if that were to happen, I would absolutely welcome those things, but it's not. That's no longer the goal for me. Mm. You know, I think for a while, I would say if you asked me like 5 years ago, the goal would be like, oh yeah, something commercial and big and impressive. And I don't know what that is now. Because it's going to be beyond the scope of theater. Mm. And I don't know what that is. You know, and I only ask myself this because, you know, there's been a kind of cycling of hires around artistic directorship at regional theaters. And people have asked, do you want these jobs? Do you want that job? And I kind of go, I keep thinking I do until I get turned down from one. And then I'm relieved that I didn't get it. So part of me feels like, so it feels like emotionally or spiritually, I'm looking for some kind of change or looking for some kind of leveling up. And I don't know what that is right now. So I don't have like a hard answer for the dream thing because it was just a bigger version of what I'm doing today.
Right.
Or a bigger project. And I'm like, no, I think whatever it is, it's beyond that.
Great.
I think I just maybe need to go to like Tibet and find it.
I love it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Or that pod, the sensory deprivation pod.
I'm gonna go like, float in a pod and find that. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. And if you could tell yourself one thing, so like today, Desdemona today, if you could tell Desdemona, you know, when she was 3 or when she was 9 or when she went to high school and did Midsummer or when she went to college, like if you could tell yourself one thing, what would that be?
Oh, God. It's almost like, I don't want to like out my family, right? But in some ways it's like, it's okay that you're different, you know? Or like, I don't know. It's something around like, don't let the disappointment of other people define the choices that you make.
That is a fucking great quote.
You know? I mean, it's in some ways, it's like the only agreement you need to make is one with yourself, right? And it's hard because all we do is make agreements with other people all the time. And I think for me, the thing I'm most proud of about myself is that I feel like, at least at the moment, until I'm proven wrong, I feel like I'm at a place right now in my life where not a lot gets to me because I've come to a place of my parameters and my goals and my successes are mine to define. And this is hard when it comes to praise, too. Praise and criticism, right? The only person who I can't do this with is my mom. When my mom comes to see a show, I'm like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. I'm freaking out in the audience. You can put Charles Isherwood. You can put 1,000 Charles Isherwoods into my theater, and I wouldn't give 2 shits. Wow. You put my mom in a theater, and suddenly I'm like, biting my nails, hyperventilating in the corner. And that's, I think that's, and which is crazy, because my mom is the chillest person ever.
Right.
But that is something I still need to, like, loosen up for myself. But my... like you determine
yourself. Mortality and your mother. That's
pretty much. That's a book. That's a book right there. Mortality and your mother.
I will read that book. I would absolutely read that book.
Yeah.
All right. And we're going to wrap this up. So, yay. One last question for you.
Okay.
If you can ask me one question.
Oh my God, I wish I'd prepared for this one. I didn't know. I would have done my homework. I'm like, what do I want to ask you on this podcast?
I know. Nobody comes prepared for this. And it's always like, oh, what? What?
What? I know. I was prepared to be the interviewee.
Yes. Yeah.
This is going to be a really, it's a very superficial question, right? Rice or noodles or bread?
That's actually a really easy question for me.
Is it rice?
Noodles.
Oh, what? Okay.
I love noodles. Okay, this is really weird. So I don't really like bread. I know my parents really love bread, and they eat bread every morning. And of course, we eat rice for dinner a lot. But then if I get to choose between all of them, it's always going to be noodles. And I don't really have an answer for, like, why. Like, any kind of noodles, right? Like, yellow noodles.
Rice noodles.
Yeah, any kind. Like, pot. Yeah, any kind of noodles.
But not like macaroni.
I do not like macaroni. How do you know that?
You want the long stringy.
Yes,
this experience
yes.
of the long stringy.
Yes.
Okay.
But I mean, like, pad thai is fine. But, like, pad siu is fine. Ho fun is fine. You know, like, flat noodles is fine.
Yeah,
like, anything that's, like, noodles based. And my mom's always like, noodles make you so fat. But it's true.
Right, carby.
It's
What's
true.
What's on is rice? Rice and bread, too. The three categories of carbs, right? It's like rice, noodles, bread.
But, like, noodles, I think, are the worst out of the three. And, like, of course, I'm the one that loves that.
Did you like that episode of East Side Story? If you did, follow us on Instagram at East Side Story Pod and at Chiang Music. Go on to Apple Podcasts, rate us, review us, and don't forget to subscribe. Or if you're a Spotify user, you can also click the follow button. Even better, you can tell someone about the podcast. And the best part, they don't even have to be Asian. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you next week.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.